Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and sometimes the devil's in the details. This guy will tell you.
Your account balance will be 15% less.
That's David Certner with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. David says a very small thing could take a very large chunk out of your bottom line. Here's how large.
Your account balance will be 15% less.
So what's the cause of this account drain? Is it A, 401k fees? Over time, paying even 0.75% could really cost you. Or are we talking B, hidden credit card fees? That fine print they call your card agreement? You should read it. Or is your wallet drained by C, ATM fees? If you're not careful, you could be paying $3 or $4 every time you withdraw 20. Stick around. The answer's coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
The Fidelity Fund manager Peter Lynch once warned against investing in any idea you can't illustrate with a crayon. I'll bet you my burnt sienna you can't draw a mortgage security. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Here's the scene setter. It's Monday, August 6th, 2007. The Dow and the S&P 500 both post their biggest one-day percentage gains in more than 4 years. Wall Street cheers. Now it's Thursday, August 9th, 2007. The Dow posts its biggest one-day decline since February, 387 points, 2.8%. The S&P loses 3%. Meaningless? Irrational? Sensible? Help me, Chris Farrell. Hello, wise friend.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, but investors, I think, are having just a slight heartburn these days. What is going on here? It just seems to be so random.
When you're at moments like this in the market, psychology really takes over. I mean, you and I talk a lot about the fundamentals tests, cash flow, corporate earnings. But right now, psychology has taken over. How bad is the subprime market mess, which, by the way, is not just happening here in the U.S. It's spilling over into Europe. And maybe it's not just the subprime market. We got problems in the junk bond market. And so get a little bit of optimism, get a little bit of decent news. Traders reach for it. You get a couple of good days. Then all of a sudden, something happens. Sentiment gets negative and the market goes down. It's really a psychology-driven market as people try to figure out how bad is the mess.
Well, I feel like I heard for several months earlier this year, you know, as stocks kept rising and rising and rising, that the subprime mess, the housing market collapse, was priced into, was already factored into the market. So why is this all of a sudden a surprise?
I think there are two pieces of new information. The first was the troubles at Bear Stearns with its mortgage-backed securities hedge funds. Bear Stearns is one of the premier experts in trading mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah.
Its funds got into trouble. And then you had the news of Bank Paribas with three of its funds.
That's the French bank that suspended trading this week.
That's right. So these are two new pieces of information that all of a sudden said, no, you can't relax. No, it is not priced in the market. And by the way, how many of these securities are out there? It's the uncertainty, the magnitude of the uncertainty. And so what we're seeing is the market stumbling around, trying to figure out what's the right level. And the central bankers are sitting back and saying, I think this might be okay, but I'm going to keep a wary eye on it at the same time.
And can we expect this kind of huge market swing to just continue on for the next weeks and months?
These wild swings in the market are going to continue until investors get a better sense about what's going on. There also is a big debate, will the central bankers cut their rates? I don't think so. I don't think they want to cut their rates, but they're keeping a close eye on the market. So there's going to be rumors. They're going to cut the rates. They're going to cut rates. Well, all of a sudden, that will have an impact on the market. Yes, we're going to have a lot of wild swings until investors are more confident about the degree of the subprime problem or the central bankers cut their interest rates to prevent the industrial world slipping into recession.
All right, Chris. Well, thanks for helping us put Wall Street on the couch.
It's been fun.
So this whole mess basically comes down to bad mortgages. If you have one, the president said this week, you deserve our empathy, but not a federal bailout. Many homeowners facing default are trying to work it out with their lenders. But what if you can't figure out who that lender is? Mortgages are often sold within hours of when you sign papers, if not before. And that second lender can sell to a third, and then maybe the third pools your mortgage with a bunch of other ones and sells it to the entire stock market. So who owns it? With us to explain is Stuart Gabriel. He's a professor of finance at the UCLA Anderson School.
Typically, there are entities in the marketplace today, including major mortgage lenders, who take on the servicing role. The servicing role here means they are the ones responsible for collecting the monthly payments from the borrowers and assuring that the contractual obligations on the mortgage are met.
So you have a servicer of your mortgage, and then you also have the actual lender. And sometimes the two are the same and sometimes they're not.
That's exactly correct. And so if the mortgage is sold, oftentimes the servicer will change as well, and the servicer will not be the original lender. Your listeners certainly should look to see who they're making their monthly check out to. That would indeed be the servicer. And if there is a problem that's cropped up today, the servicer should be contacted, and oftentimes there will be an opportunity to negotiate with a servicer.
What does all this confusion and complication mean for the overall housing slump? When it gets harder and harder for people to refinance, to make a deal with the folks who own the mortgage because it's not the local bank anymore, how does that affect the overall market?
Well, we have a situation today where the mortgage markets are in a state of disarray. You have a situation in which the already weak housing market is going to become weaker. Fewer borrowers are going to be able to qualify to purchase a given home. Fewer borrowers are going to have adequate disposable income left after they pay their mortgage payment. And with the added stress of what's going on in mortgage markets could, of course, lead us into a more generally weak economic situation.
Stuart Gabriel is director of the Ziman Center for Real Estate at UCLA. Thanks for helping us parse this out.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
With no end in sight to the subprime mortgage crisis, it's nice to know some of us can count on 401k plans. A new study says our contributions are up over the past few years, but we're not paying enough attention to the fees and surcharges. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Maybe it's a genetic thing. It just seems like the inclination to stash money instead of spend it right away somehow comes from our parents. Tech guru David Berlin says fear drove him to sock away cash for his nest egg.
That's what parents do. They scare you into thinking like bad things can happen if you don't do that. And so I listened.
Each year, Berlin fills his 401k to the tax-free max, up to the amount his employer CNET Networks will match. He recently switched to a lifestyle fund that automatically correlates his investment strategy to his target retirement date. But while he's diligent about his retirement bottom line, he's less concerned about the fine print, like account fees.
I'm not clear that spending a whole lot of time on these little fees is going to make a really big difference when it comes time for my wife and I to retire.
According to retiree group AARP, more than 80% of us don't know how much we pay in expenses on our 401ks. David Sertner with the AARP says those fees may seem like a small slice of your savings, but the net effect adds up over your working life.
If you, for example, charge fees of less than 1%, so 0.75 over, say, a 20-year time horizon, you're going to see your benefits, your account balance will be 15% less.
Fees can be difficult to avoid. There are commissions and management debits, the cost of account maintenance, and investment advice. Sertner says funds that take a lot of time to manage usually come with higher fees, while index funds tend to be cheaper. You can compare prices on your account summary description plan. If you can't find it or can't understand the legal speak, you can do what I did and call them up.
You're on a recorded line with Mike Drulo. Okay, Mike.
Mike told me my real estate fund charged a fee of 0.79%, while the bond fund charged 0.45%. Then I asked him about fees on what was listed as a group annuity account.
I don't think we actually have those available or have a breakdown of what the expenses are.
This information lapse didn't surprise Ken Weber with Weber Asset Management. He says many 401k funds come not just with stated fees, but hidden fees.
It's the dirty little secret. Lots and lots of people in my industry are getting fat off the backs of 40 or 50 million Americans who are in 401k plans.
Weber's advice, avoid group annuities because their fees aren't comparable to publicly traded funds. He's also wary of programs that say fees waived. He says that can mean they're waived right over to the employee's account. Employers have a legal duty to make sure 401k charges are reasonable. Some in Congress are now calling for federal legislation that would require investment firms to fully explain 401k charges in plain language. But then we'd have one less excuse for not checking on those fees. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yes, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school is in session. This week, we'll talk about a number that plays a big part in your financial life, your credit score. At the blackboard today, economist Greg McBride of Bankrate.com.
A credit score is a three-digit number that depicts your credit history, how you've paid your bills, how much debt you have, how much debt you have relative to how much credit lenders are willing to give you. All of that together is really fundamental to what you pay whenever you borrow, but also very important for things such as insurance premiums or even your employment. Now, the range goes from 350 to about 850. If you're over 700, you should generally qualify for some of the best rates in the market. And if you're above 750 on your credit score, then you're a shoo-in for the best rates that are available. As your credit score declines, you'll find that you're paying higher rates because the lower credit score represents a riskier borrower. If your credit score dips below 650, then you are in what is known as subprime territory. And they can expect to pay considerably higher rates than the borrowers that may have a substantially higher credit score and represent less risk to lenders. There are two components alone that comprise about two-thirds of your credit score. The first is paying your bills on time. The second is the amount of debt you have and the amount of debt that you have relative to your available credit. What that means is how much of that credit card balance have you used? If you have a credit card with a $10,000 line of credit, but you're running an $8,000 balance, that's going to work against your score. What you want to do is you want to make all of your payments on time and you want to work over time towards paying down your debt and keeping that debt low. That shows that you are responsible when it comes to using credit. That's going to boost your credit score.
Our teacher this week was Greg McBride of Bankrate.com. Next week's class, how you feeling? Consumer sentiment. One of our listeners recently discovered some lost stock, but Chris warned not to forget about the tax man. And want a job that's a real challenge?
There's no real good way to prepare an indigenous leader coming from the Amazon into a corporate boardroom and speak in front of 1,000 shareholders.
A day in the work life of a corporate watchdog. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. Folks are more interested than ever in alternative energy, but meanwhile, most stuff still runs on oil, and oil companies will go to the ends of the earth to get it. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet an activist trying to protect the ends of the earth and the people who live there. Her latest action? Sending native South American leaders to a petroleum expo to confront the corporations.
Hello?
Hi, Maria. It's Atosa. I wanted to get a report back on how today went.
Very well.
What was their expressions like? Were they just flabbergasted to see folks in traditional dress walk into the expo?
They were just in total shock. And he was, I didn't even know where to hide.
My name is Atossa Sultani. I'm the founder and the executive director of Amazon Watch.
And he didn't know where to hide.
You know, one suggestion, Maria, trying to get a photo in the Chronicle, because a picture of this press conference sent back to Peru will be definitely golden.
Well, I think I was 17 years old. I got involved in a citizen action campaign in Ohio to stop a nuclear power plant. And we did it. We were able to stop this nuclear power plant in southern Ohio. So it gave me confidence and learned that when people do organize, they can make a difference. We have a twofold approach. We do the work on the ground in the Amazon, backbinding, working with communities to establish legal protection for their land and their rights. Up here, we're working to pressure the decision makers. We're bringing the voices of the ones affected to the doorstep of the banks and the oil companies and the governments. There's no real good way to prepare an indigenous leader coming from the Amazon or their homeland into a corporate boardroom and speak in front of 1,000 shareholders. There's no good way to do that. I remember when the UWA leaders from Colombia came to Los Angeles to speak at Oxy's annual shareholders meeting, they would say to us that when they go home, they have to spend several weeks fasting and cleansing before they're allowed to be reunited in their communities because they are considered contaminated when they return from our world. As executive director of Amazon Watch, I'm earning $50,000 a year. And that was just as of December. Before that, I was earning about $42,000. We are able to provide employees with health and dental. And so if you're in the middle of the Amazon and you get sick, we actually have a good health plan that can get you out of there to definitive care. We've had employees get really bad stuff, like, you know, you can imagine Giardia, you know, a lot of stomach stuff, which is not fun. There are a lot of dangers in the places where we go, so we definitely have to take the risks into account. You know, I think we go through phases. There are phases in Amazon Watch's year where we are working literally 14-hour days and we have late nights and weekends and we're on call. I think there can be burnout. Basically, by middle of December, most of my staff was complaining about burnout. And the only reason I wasn't is because I was trying to hold it up that I wasn't burned out. But it happens. I think nonprofits can be especially susceptible to that because we want to please. We want to serve these communities. It's really hard to say, no, I'm sorry, you know, I need to get some sleep tonight.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Karen Ness.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by the FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Positive thinking brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, blank check IPO. A blank check IPO is like a regular IPO for optimists. Investors give money to get in on the ground floor of a company, but it has no business plan and no stated purpose. Regulators worry investors might get burned, but it hasn't hindered blank check's popularity. This year, they made up about a quarter of U.S. IPOs. One, China Holdings Acquisition Corp., filed this week. They want to raise $100 million to do something in China. They're not sure what. A suggestion? Start an overdraft protection company.
Got a box full of letters. Thinking might like to read.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland, and it's that time when we answer your burning financial questions. Chris Farrell is here. Most of you know him as our economics expert. He's also a big music buff. What's in your iPod this week, Chris?
Oh, I got all kinds of things. Just downloaded a good Van Halen song.
Oh, so you're a headbanger.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. You know, music went downhill when Guns N' Roses broke up.
Oh, my goodness. Well, before anyone starts banging their head because they have so many questions for us and we're not answering them yet, please do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Our first caller is an avid listener to the Marketplace Mailbag. He's definitely an example of how you can benefit from listening to the show each and every week. Joe is on the line from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Joe, why don't you tell everyone what you've gained by listening to the show?
Well, when you were doing the show about the websites where people go to find unclaimed property and things like that, I happened to be half listening to that while I was working on my computer. The next day, I was like, you know, I'm going to go to the website and check it out. Found the links. And went to, I guess I can say it, missingmoney.com, you said it, and typed in my information. And after a few seconds, 10 hits came up, and 7 of them had to do with me.
Fantastic.
It turned out that there was some stock that was joint tenancy with myself and my father, which had somehow fallen through the cracks and was being held by the state of Pennsylvania. So then I called them up and spoke to the treasurer's office and got a very nice woman, and I gave her some basic information. And then I said, what are we talking about here? And she says, somewhere in excess of $62,000.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It took me a while to kind of believe it. And she says, you're listed as one of the co-owners. And she said, that's a walk in the park.
Well, it sounds like you've already answered a lot of the questions for yourself. So how can we help you today?
I guess my main question is now is I haven't been missing it, unfortunately, all these years. So I want to take a bulk of that and reinvest it. So that's one question. I mean, should I just throw it right back into the telephone company, which is where it was before, or whether there are some better options? And what are my tax liabilities going to be on this? Because the stock was co-owned with myself and my dad, and dad is now deceased since 2001, and how that all plays out.
All right, Chris, well, let's start with the question of taxes. What kind of hit is he likely to take on this?
Well, I have a one-word answer to this, accountant. Because I do think this is a lot of money, and this is one of those situations where I definitely will pay to have an accountant. My guess is, and maybe you know, Joe, that this was a, what we call a custodial account.
Right.
Custodial account is a way that parents can give stock to their children when they're a minor. If you get it in terms of stock, then your big tax obligation comes when you decide to sell it.
Okay, which I'm not.
Right. So, you know, you can sort of sit back and say, okay, well, I haven't known about it and it's been rolling around for all this time. You know, I'm going to hold on to it. If you have other purposes, you know, saving for college education or something like that, you can sort of evaluate that situation. So that's really the main thing. But I definitely would work with an accountant just to make sure.
Well, I have an accountant who does my taxes mm-hmm. each year. And he's always asking me lots of questions about what's going on with my stock, what kind of stock I have, and, you know, and says, to, you know, he's pretty good about looking out for me. So should I approach him with this problem?
Oh, absolutely. This is the bread and butter to accountants. They love this kind of problem. This is wonderful. So, yes, absolutely. I would definitely approach him.
Well, congratulations again on your newfound money.
Yeah. And I've been telling other people and they've gone investigating and have found stuff as well. So, you know, I'm even more avid listener than I was before.
Oh, we love to hear that.
All right. You've answered my questions.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, let's reach into the email bag. Sue writes in from San Diego, California, and she's 60 and a half years old. And just over 5 years ago, she suffered an accident that's made it impossible for her to keep working on a steady basis. She's been granted disability by Social Security. But in the meantime, she's been drawing from her personal savings and her Roth IRA. But her home is worth more than twice what she paid for it. So she's writing in to ask what the pros and cons are of something called a reverse mortgage. So let's define that first of all. What is a reverse mortgage?
It's a loan against your home, but you don't have to pay it back so long as you live in this home. It's a way of getting an income out of the equity of your home, which you then pay back when you move or you pass away.
So if she opens one of these, is that something that you do for the entire amount of the equity that you own?
Okay, now there's a couple things. First of all, you can't take out a reverse mortgage until you're 62 years or older.
Okay, so she's got about a year and a half before she can do this then.
Which is good, because I'm a fan of reverse mortgages, and I'm becoming more of a fan of reverse mortgages. But it's a complicated product, and they're not easy to evaluate. There's required consulting session before you take out a reverse mortgage. So it's a big step. One source that I would recommend for anybody who's thinking about a reverse mortgage, it just came out, and it's at the website of the AARP. I would strongly recommend it. It's an introduction to reverse mortgages, and it's very clear, lays out how they work, and how much money you can get out of your home test is a combination of your age, current interest rates, and how much equity you have in your home. So the older you are, for example, the more money you'll be able to borrow against the value of your home.
Is there a calculator there that might help her figure that out?
There's calculators on the AARP website.
Great.
And it's a good calculator. The other thing is to seriously think about how does a reverse mortgage, this is a classic example. We talk about this a lot. This is a classic example of you don't just want to look and understand a financial product. It's how does the financial product fit into some other broader questions about how are you going to be living? What are you doing? One of the things that I like about the publication is that they do discuss some of the alternatives. Sell your home, move to a smaller home, rent. You need to consider those alternatives seriously before you take out a reverse mortgage.
So do a little more research and best of luck to you. And when we say we can help, we do mean it. The only way we can figure out a solution to your problem is if you let us know what your problem is. So click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, caller number two is Linda from Kingston, New York. Welcome, Linda.
Hi.
Tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm a nurse in Ulster County, New York. I manage people who receive home care.
Oh, wow. So do you actually go to their homes and take care of them? Is this like a hospice?
Yeah, I don't do that. I case manage, so I just keep everybody sorted out, basically.
All right. So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I work for a private company that does not contribute to our 401k plans. When I listen to finance programs, I often hear that I should be checking my plan, but really I don't know what I'm looking for. I'm 53, so I'm mainly in the income-producing category with 30% growth. I don't really know what that means in detail, aside from the obvious meaning of those words. I don't have time to check out the individual companies specifically. So how much control do I have over the investments? What am I looking for? Of course, I check the amounts when I get my statements, cause the sorrow when they go down, naturally, and relief when they improve. But beyond that, it's a bit of a puzzle for me. And the other thing is, what percentage of my income should I be contributing at my age?
Okay. Well, great questions and very common ones. My guess is that, first of all, the question about where her allocations are, that depends on what kind of investments the company allows, isn't it?
That's right. Everyone who's in a 401k or a 403b, which is really different numbers, but essentially the same type of plan, you're limited to the choices that your company has chosen for you. So spend the bulk of your time figuring out, okay, am I in the right choices within the limits of my plan? Have I picked the right three or four for me, equities, bonds, maybe a little bit of international? So that's really the first thing is, you know, a limited number of funds, broad base as possible, expose yourself to the U.S. market, expose yourself to the international market, expose yourself to the creditworthy part of the bond market.
Chris, she said that she, did you say you're 53?
Yes.
So is there kind of a general rule for how much at her age she should be in stocks versus bonds versus international funds?
Your classic division is 60% stocks, 40% bonds. That's where most people should start out. And then you make adjustments. If you're willing to take a little more risk, you up the equity portion, shrink the bond portion. If that concept just makes you nervous, okay, up the bond portion, shrink the equity portion.
All right. And what about the question of how much she should be setting aside in the 401k, again, at her age of 53?
Well, I think the really simple answer is the maximum that you can. For most people, that's going to come down to about 10% of their income. And once you hit 55, you'll be able to put in a little bit of extra money if you can do that.
All right. Does that help you out?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Terrific. Well, thanks for the call. All right. Well, retiring is certainly almost everyone's dream, if you're ready or not, or if you want to talk about any other financial matter, we can help. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, I want to ask you a quick question in regards to a question that we had from a listener last week. We got several emails in response to it, and this was the woman, I'm sure you'll remember, whose husband, who has now passed away, opened an individual credit card. But unfortunately, the credit card company still says that the widow is responsible for what was on that card. And it's gone from a balance of like $8,000 to something around $27,000 because of fees and interest and all that. So we counseled her that she actually would not lose her home. But we did have an attorney write in from Columbus, Ohio, who says, actually, it kind of depends on where you're living. And in fact, in Ohio, they can come after you and your home, even if it wasn't your credit card, if it was your spouse's credit card.
That's a good point. Very, very good point. I'm glad. By the way, this is why we love these emails.
Absolutely. And we also got a note from Teresa Kramer in Tallahassee, Florida, who had a suggestion, and I want to get your comments on this. She suggested that the widow buy up some shares of MBNA, which is the credit card company, and then as a shareholder, see what they can do for her. What do you think of that? Little backdoor policy there?
You know, I think that's actually a very clever idea. I think at some level, the only return on that investment is satisfaction. I don't think there's any real practical implications, but hey, why not?
All right, well, let's reach into the email bag one more time. Mary is writing in from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and her good friend recently moved to Costa Rica to sell some pre-construction condos in a family business with her husband. Her friend told Mary that the condo purchase is a U.S. government-sanctioned investment and that a lot of couples in their 50s are purchasing these condos with funds from their IRAs. So Mary thinks this sounds pretty good. Have you ever heard of this?
Yes, I have heard of this. Boy, I have a couple of reactions. You know, back in 2003, 2004, there actually was a pretty decent little game going on where you go into a development, you buy pre-construction, and then by the time it gets done, you'd sell it to somebody else, mm-hmm. make a little bit of profit.
We call it flipping.
We call it flipping. Now, guess what's happened recently? No more market. It's dried up. You want to sell it, it's at a loss. This is speculation beyond speculation. And what are people doing with their retirement money speculating in this type of investment? This is not what you should be doing with your IRA money. I cannot say that strong enough.
All right. There you go, Mary. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take today. But please do send in your comments for a future show. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Chris, thanks for helping us all in the game of survival of the financial fittest.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, our San Jose Investment Club gets downright saucy when it comes to Wall Street.
I find unusual investment-y things sexy. Yes.
And if you thought around the world in 60 days was a stretch, try 6,000 miles in 27 hours. We'll talk to an airline mileage runner. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Vigeland. Back now to our series about investment clubs. We're following three of them in Seattle, San Jose, and Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
We return to San Jose for lunch at the Italian joint called Frankie, Johnny, and Luigi's. Our last visit was back in April. Now, as then, just four club members in attendance, Martha Alderson, Alan Smith, Kathy Tegmeyer, and Marvin Cohn, all with the same thirst for a summer drink.
Iced tea.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
We heard from this club a couple of weeks ago when they shared how they deal with big market swings. They were a prescient bunch the day before a stock market rout. So we'll get right to how the club is doing for 2007. Alderson is the group's treasurer and says they're up about 1.5% since April.
We had 8 holdings in April, and now we've got 7.
And what's your total amount invested at this point?
total amount invested is almost $26,000. The total pie is $33,075.
Gosh, it seems like only yesterday we were down at $22,000.
Why do you have so much cash right now?
We want to go to Hawaii.
One of the reasons we have so much cash is that even though we keep finding things to buy, something will happen to a stock we already own. Like we very recently, probably in the last 6 months, had decided to purchase a stock called Tier 1, and then a big buyout was announced, and we didn't like the company that was going to be buying them out, so we just decided we're going to let go of that holding.
So you have cash from selling a stock?
Yeah, we have some cash from selling a stock. We keep trying to buy and build up, and then inevitably we end up selling something, and so we've had about this much cash on the balance sheet rotating through for a while now, and we're trying to. We want to be more fully invested.
But the other thing we want to be careful of is that our investments are balanced. We sold a company in the financial sector, so both Kathy and I have looked for replacements in the same sector.
Tier 1 isn't the only stock they sold in the last 3 months. Also gone, Chico's, the women's clothing store. It was on the chopping block at their meeting in April.
We felt very strongly about the original Chico's product line and its customer base. And they started branching into a much younger marketplace, kind of neglecting their bread and butter customers. And they just weren't as successful. And the numbers were reflecting that. And we just kind of went, you know, we're not going to wait for them to figure this out and get their act together.
Another company faces the axe at this meeting. The group has owned stock in Brown & Brown, an insurance brokerage, for 4 years. But Smith and Cohn sense problems.
I'm in favor of getting rid of Brown & Brown, actually.
Brown & Brown?
Yeah, their performance is, and it's the trend isn't slowing.
The trend is down. Their growth is still reasonably good. It's about 14%. Year over year for the last quarter.
Well, they have digestion problems. They're buying companies. That's their growth.
Yes.
And oftentimes it just takes a lot longer to digest and get the economies of scale.
I haven't seen any analysis on Brown & Brown. I know it's going down, but if it continues that trend, it doesn't seem to be like a company we want to have at this moment in time.
You know, realistically, I think we should be watching it.
Watching it or sell? I mean, because we haven't seen any data, so it's unfair just to simply sell on a gut reaction. I mean, if I had to, I'd say sell, but make a decision maybe in August whether we hang on or sell.
So they'll give Brown & Brown a little more time to shape up. And then the fun part, spending the cash they had available in their investment pot. Kathy Tegmeyer had already done some research into possible stocks in the financial sector to replace the Tier 1 bank stock they sold.
And I found a niche that was pretty interesting to me, and that's there are three banks that cater specifically to Chinese living in the U.S. So the three companies are UCBH Holdings, East West Bank Corp., and Cathay General Bank Corp. Looking at the three companies and their history, I think East West Bank Corp. may be our best bet.
It markets its services in the L.A. metropolitan area, Orange County, the San Francisco Bay Area, San Mateo County, Silicon Valley. So far as we here are concerned, this is a neighborhood bank. Not all bad buying stock from a company that, you know, drive by and see what people are walking in and out.
Clearly, you can see that it's a company that's well managed, under control, and is constantly growing in the right direction. There isn't a single year in which it's, you know, really going wrong.
Well, how about
$8,000?
I propose for East West Bank Corp. buying 100 shares.
How much would that give us as a stake?
That would be about $3,800.
Okay, that's fine.
So we're going to go ahead and buy 100 shares of East West?
Yeah, I would vote for that.
Okay, good.
So, Kathy, you got a little smile on your face that you guys are investing in East West Bank.
One of my struggles is that you fall in love with a company, and then you are emotional about what you're buying and selling. It's a pleasure to bring stocks to this club meeting that other people look at and go, yes, that looks good.
I think this looks pretty sexy.
You just called East West Bank sexy?
Yes.
I find unusual investment-y things sexy.
Yes.
And with that, they adjourned.
By the way, if you're interested in finding out more about investment clubs, there's a conference called InvestEd here in Southern California next weekend. Marvin and Kathy and some of the others from the San Jose Club will be there. We've got a link to more information on our website, marketplace.org. Click on the Investment Club link. Next week, our Virginia Club, formerly Baroque, is far from it.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
This week, Virgin America made its inaugural flight. The new airline promises the comfort of a massage chair, bargain prices, and cushy, no-layover flights. That last part might not sit well with a slightly twisted subspecies of Homo sapiens called mileage runners. The longer the flight, the more stops they make, the more air miles they can bank. Dave Demergen is a writer with Wired magazine, and he wrote about his own recent 6,000-mile, six-flight nightmare, mileage run. Dave, any plans to do it again?
That would be a big no. And when I started, I've loved airlines since I was a little kid, and I was really excited to go on these mileage runs. But there's just something to be said for sitting in an airplane seat in coach for 27 hours and, you know, eating United Airlines snack packs for an entire day. It sucks.
Well, tell us a little bit about your experience and what you did for Wired magazine.
Well, you know, I do a lot of writing about commercial aviation and airlines and was telling my editor about these mileage runners. And he was fascinated by it and gave it some thought and decided he was going to give me $500 and ask me to learn how to do mileage runs of my own and then to write about it.
What did $500 get you?
$500 got me two runs. One of them was Boston to Las Vegas round trip, where I stopped in Washington, D.C., San Diego, San Francisco, Chicago for $275. And the second one was an easier run. I went Boston, Washington, Washington, Philly, Philly, Detroit, Detroit, Philly, Philly, New York, New York, Boston.
And that was considered one ticket?
That was one ticket. That was one ticket. That one was $196 round trip.
And that's in one day?
That one I did in one day, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, take us through how you actually are able to do this, because I know when I book flights, at the most, usually what you'll have is maybe two, maybe three layovers. But to get yourself where you have, well, how many stops did you have on that second one?
Four on the second one, five on the first one.
So how do you even book that?
What you need to learn is that every fare has a series of rules attached to it, and it takes a long time to find the rules on these different websites. But one of the things that rule dictates is how many stops you can make. And while most people will make, as you said, one connection or two, a lot of times the rules say that you can make up to six or sometimes even more connections on a single ticket without changing the fare. So once you've learned how to interpret those rules and kind of understand where the different airlines fly, you can put together a run that has six or seven stops without breaking the fare.
All right. So how many miles did you rack up?
Well, the first trip, which was the Las Vegas trip, if I had done the nonstop, that would have come in at just over 4,000 miles. I was able to get close to 7,000 miles with the extra connections. So I almost doubled my miles on that one. The second one, I wasn't really aiming for miles as much as I was for segments. So I kept the flights short up and down the East Coast and racked up, I think, eight segments on that trip.
Now, why were you going for segments? Was that because you were on, I know like Southwest, you rack up points based on how many segments you fly. Were you on Southwest?
I wasn't. I was on US Air, but with all of the airline frequent flyer programs, you will reach elite status either by flying a certain number of miles in a year or a certain number of segments in a year. And one of the mileage runners that I spoke to research the story suggested that since I live on the East Coast and there's a lot of cities close to each other, I should be going for segments instead of miles.
Is there anything that would make it worth it? When we first started discussing your story in our editorial meeting, the question that came up around the table was, what would make it worth it for you to do it? And one of my colleagues said, you know, would you do this? And I said, absolutely not. He said, well, what if you could fly all day and that would get you a free ticket? And I thought, you know, I might be willing to take one day off and fly around the country in order to get, you know, a free ticket somewhere. Is there some point at which it would be worth it to you?
I mean, I think the thing that killed me was sitting in coach. One of the runners that I talked to research this story did a run to Singapore via Hong Kong and Los Angeles. He was basically in a plane for 38 hours, but he spent the entire time in Singapore Airlines first class, which is pretty much the nicest way you can fly. And he basically got plied with free alcohol, gourmet food, and, you know, magazines the entire way, and said that it was just kind of like a 2-day vacation. So if I was being waited on in a fully reclinable sleeper seat, I might think about it.
But otherwise, no way.
I don't think so.
All right. Well, is there any sort of, I don't know, milder form of this that kind of a normal traveler could practice? If we wanted to get a little more out of a regular trip, what kinds of things could we do?
Well, one thing that a lot of business travelers will do who don't consider themselves mileage runners but who want to rack up some extra miles is they'll just tack an extra connection onto their trip. So if they're going from, you know, New York to Chicago, they might add a connection in D.C. if they can pull it off, and that will get them an extra couple thousand miles. And if they do that a few times over the course of a year, they've done pretty well.
Dave Demergen is a writer for Wired Magazine. Thanks for going through this for all of us.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, I don't know about you, but I'm glad I'm not trying to pay for college right now.
Well, I am helping to pay for college.
Ah, yes, you are.
It's expensive.
Then, as you know, the cost of a college degree just keeps going up and up and up, and public universities are always scrambling for more cash. But I recently read in the New York Times about one tactic that just takes the cake here. Some of these places are now charging higher tuition if students major in certain subjects?
That's right. So a student majors in engineering. That student will pay more than an undergraduate that majors in English. Hmm. In other words, and here's the theory, you're going to pay more to major in a field that has a high starting salary when you graduate. Now, Tess, normally at this part of the, you know, the straight story, I like to drive you a little crazy and point out the gray areas. This time around, no. Here's a straight story. Charging undergraduates more for certain degrees is short-sighted, bad for students, bad for universities, and bad for society.
Well, so are we looking just really at a bottom line issue here? What's really behind this shift to, I guess we'd call it differential pricing?
That's right. Now, in fairness to the universities that are doing this, they're not happy about it, but they're doing it, or here's the justification why they say they're doing it. Most important justification is that, you know, state support of public universities has been lagging. May get a little bit better for a year or two because state coffers are flush, but we've gone through a period mm-hmm. where a lot of states really had budget problems, lots of cutting. Certain fields also are more expensive to support. Professors can command a higher salary, need better computers, better research facilities. So that's the justification that is being made. I don't buy it.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Okay.
In a way, isn't this more fair? I mean, why should an art major who's going to graduate and live on ramen noodles be paying as much as someone who might work for Morgan Stanley straight out of school?
But it could be that art graduate that ends up going to Morgan Stanley straight out of school, for one thing. But I think there are several
reasons. A little artistic license in the market?
A little. Absolutely. You know, there's a poet at Morgan Stanley, very good poet, published poet. Anyway, there are several major objections. One major objection has to do with low-income students. Mm. The University of Kansas, they've been doing this since the early 1990s. And they say that they're starting to see anecdotal evidence that low-income students are starting to concentrate in areas like history and stay away from the more expensive majors, business and engineering. We don't want this to happen. The other thing is what we want from our universities, it's a unique time in a young person's life to explore. And I don't know about your friends, but I would imagine you knew people who went in and they were going to major in this. They're freshmen, they're 18 years old, then they're 19 years old, they're a sophomore, they're going to major in this. I mean, you want people to move around, shift, follow their passion, follow their interests. But the final point, right now we know that something's a well-paying salary, but you know what one of the hottest areas in business today has to do with graphic design. Hello, Apple.
Yep.
Okay. Now, 10 years ago, would you have predicted that graphic design would be a graphic design broadly defined, industrial design, you know, that this would be a hot area? You have to be careful. So this is a stage of life for sampling, for, you know, getting certain credentials. And I just think it's a step in the wrong direction.
Well, and aside from perhaps, you know, changing your mind in the middle of school, this could really also keep graduates out of nonprofit work. You know, they get a degree in science that the university decides should cost them more. Then they get out. They've got so much more debt that they don't want to take this low-paying nonprofit gig or teach.
That's right. And you know what? People make these choices when they go into graduate school, and there it's legitimate. People have gone through college, they're more adults, they're making career choices, but not on the undergraduate level. And this concern about minority students, would you be adding another disincentive toward minority students to go into certain fields? You don't want to go in that direction.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks as always for helping all of us get our degrees in personal finance education.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our Virginia Investment Club gets personal over whether to stick with or dump a stock.
This is one I would still watch. Some of the other ones, it's like, as I said, it's like breaking up with a boyfriend. You're just not going back there.
But don't break up with us if you missed any part of the show. We've got the whole thing, including a podcast, at marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.